Welcome to East West Medicine, where we discuss diverse approaches to healthcare. We are your hosts, Lily Love, MD, MBA, with a background in ENT head and neck surgery and facial plastic and reconstructive surgery.
And Sudha Kailas, MD, PhD, with a background in psychiatry, neuroscience, pediatrics, and Ayurvedic medicine.
The information presented is not medical advice. If you have a concern, please contact your healthcare provider. So welcome back. We're here with East West Medicine, and our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Wheaton, who's MD, DDS, oral maxillofacial surgery, or oral surgery, since, as he mentioned, it was a mouthful. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you.
So today we were going to talk a little bit about dental implants. That's been in the news a lot, that kind of in older days people would put in these implants with different metals that now people are having different reactions to, or they're maybe not good for you. So can you kind of educate our listeners and us a little bit about that?
Okay. Basically, when I first started out 10, 15 years ago, most of my job was taking out bad teeth. And then the dentists would traditionally restore that with a removable partial denture or what we call a fixed bridge. Dental implants have been around about 40 years, but I would say in the last 5 years, they've really gained mainstream acceptance. People are expecting to come in now and replace missing teeth with dental implants. It's not so much that the metal has changed. I think the surface technology, the design of implants has changed a lot, and they're a lot more predictable now than they were 30, 40 years ago. So no procedure is 100% success, but dental implants currently in the lower jaw have about a 97% success rate. And in the upper jaw, the maxilla, where the bone is softer, spongier, it's a little lower than that, but it's still about 94%. So dental implants have gotten to be very predictable, and they're not really seen as experimental or a luxury item anymore. People are expecting them. Generally, they're made of medical grade type 4 titanium. It's the same type of titanium as would be in a hip replacement or a knee replacement, and it's the most inert material that we have, the least bioreactive. But there are some concerns. There are patients who maybe feel that they may have metal allergies or have concerns about that, and there are some new alternatives starting to appear as well.
What are some of those alternatives? What other metals can you use?
Basically, the alternative to the titanium implants is what's called zirconium. It's a very strong porcelain-type material, and that's what a lot of the patients who are concerned about environmental sensitivities or more into, say, holistic dentistry, if you do any searching online, you'll see a lot about zirconium implants. Now, what I tell patients when they come in is we don't have a 40-year track history with zirconium as we do with titanium. I am open to placing them, but I think patients need to be properly informed that we don't have as long a data with zirconium. And some of the concerns I have are it may be more brittle, so it may not hold up under stress as long as titanium. So it may be more prone to chipping or fracturing over time. We just don't know. And the other thing is they come as a one-piece block of zirconium. Titanium implants have two pieces. The main implant body screws into the jawbone, and then they have what's called an abutment, which is threaded. That screws into the implant. That's the portion that comes out through the gum tissue. The advantage to having it as a two-piece system is we can change the angulation with the abutment. So we're able to correct angulation errors or issues and try to get the best cosmetic result or the best bite alignment. And zirconium being a one-piece doesn't give you as much flexibility. But I believe patients being properly educated and informed adults can make their own decisions as long as they know the pros and cons of each.
Now, can you do this with all teeth or just the front teeth? Or, I mean, could you make any tooth with an implant?
Theoretically, we can replace any tooth with an implant. Realistically, we don't ever do wisdom teeth, you know, obviously. Even second molars, they get more difficult. As you go towards the back part of the mouth hinges, and there's less working space, so it's very tight space to try to get the drills, again, to get the right angulation. It used to be when I was starting out 15 years ago, we actively discouraged patients from getting second molar implants just because it was harder for us to do. But last few years, I've done more second molar implants than ever because patients are realizing if you lost a bottom second molar, that opposing tooth on the top could eventually drift down. We call that super eruption. So patients not wanting to see that happen are coming in and saying, can you do an implant in this area? And the answer is yes. It's just technically a little more difficult. Some of the other anatomical constraints we have is the posterior maxilla, the back part of the upper jaw. The sinuses dip way down in that location. If you look at an x-ray, it's actually normal anatomy that the roots of those teeth go right up into the sinus. And oftentimes after a patient has lost a tooth there just isn't enough bone basically to place an implant, or we'd get into the sinus. So that can be an issue. Generally speaking, the lower jaw we could do almost anywhere. The upper jaw, because the bone is softer and we have the sinuses and other issues like that, sometimes the upper jaw can be a little more challenging.
What's the average life of one of these implants? I mean, should someone expect to have it for the rest of their life, or do they need to be changed out at a certain point?
Again, I tell my patients in the consult, nothing is 100%, but I really do believe nowadays implants have a better success rate than root canals and bridges and crowns over time. Whenever you work on a tooth, you weaken it, and a tooth that has had a root canal is a dead tooth. It's dry. It doesn't have the same moisture and water content. So what will happen with a root canal tooth with a crown is I'll often see them 10, 15 years later when the tooth splits and fractures and then is lost. So my feeling is I tell patients that if it's done properly, I think an implant should last the rest of your life. But like our teeth, you have to take care of them. You have to go into the dentist once or twice a year, get cleanings. You have to brush and floss around the implant. Implants won't decay like teeth, but they can lose bone. So if you get inflammation or infection around them, you can actually get bone loss, and then the implant can come loose and come out. So just like you have to take care of your teeth, you have to take care of implants. But if you do, I believe they should last the rest of your life.
What about fillings? There's a lot of controversy these days about mercury fillings and getting mercury fillings removed followed by chelation therapy, or just the filling removed and no chelation therapy. I was wondering what your thoughts are about this.
Right. It's not necessarily reflecting my thoughts, but I would say the ADA has not changed its position at all. They still adamantly say that amalgam fillings are safe and an important tool in our toolbox for treating dental disease. Having said that, I found most of my colleagues here in Santa Fe nowadays, if you're going to be placing a new filling, would probably not place a silver filling. I don't know if it's mostly responding to the wishes of the customer in this area in the market, but the new tooth-colored materials, the resins, are actually much stronger than they used to be 20 years ago. So I kind of follow along those lines. I feel like if there are newer materials that can avoid amalgam, that's what we would tend to use. I would say about removing amalgam, though, that's a very different issue, because
yes,
a lot of patients go in and they want to have all their silver fillings removed. Science shows us that the small amount of mercury that is in the amalgam alloy is bound up when that metal sets up. It is locked into a crystalline structure, and it is not released. When you cut out a silver filling, then free mercury is released. So you're actually going to be getting potentially more mercury by digging out all of your old silver fillings than just leaving them. So that's something to think about.
What kinds of procedures would need to be done in addition to remove the mercury in order to do it safely?
Well, from a dental perspective, and that's all I can really talk about. I'm not an alternative practitioner, and again, I'm open to alternative therapies. I think if patients want to do things that they feel is helpful, I'm fine with that as long as it doesn't interfere with what I believe my best practices are. But you know, from a dental perspective, the safest way to remove an amalgam filling is to use a rubber dam. That way it blocks off the oral cavity from – it basically sequesters the tooth and isolates the tooth. And then we also use high-speed suction, high-speed evacuation to remove any aerosolized amalgam and mercury, as well as water cooling that down. The big fear is you don't want to aerosolize the mercury and have that breathed in. So
Yes. The
combination of using a high-speed suction and the rubber dam is the most technical, the best technical way to reduce that. In terms of chelation, that's not really my area of expertise. And that's why I'm saying if someone wants to pursue that, I'm fine, but I'm not really sure of the pros or cons of that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And what about amalgam tattoos? I mean, sometimes in oral cavity exam, you'll see these kind of black marks all around, and it's just because of these fillings. Is it at the time of putting it in that people tend to get those? Or
it is. It's literally like a tattoo. If you get a x-ray of that area, you can actually sometimes even see little bits of metal embedded in the soft tissue. Mm-hmm. So when a large filling is being placed mm-hmm. or removed, like for a crown preparation, then some of that metal could embed into the adjacent soft tissue. And I'll sometimes get patients referred for a black spot on their gums, and the dentist is, do a biopsy. Maybe this is a melanoma, mm-hmm. When it's actually an amalgam tattoo. So that's
same in my practice, yeah. Right. Well, that's really interesting. But now you primarily use these, what's the new, the white-colored?
I actually still primarily use titanium for almost everyone. It has the titanium implants have a longer history. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, strength and predictability. I am open to using and am starting to use some of the zirconium now because they are FDA approved. And as long as it's FDA approved for use and a patient really doesn't want metal in their mouth, I don't want to deny them the opportunity to replace that tooth. So, yes,
I am. Don't do fillings, though.
I don't do fillings. Okay. When I take out oral surgeons, we mostly remove teeth and mm-hmm. we do surgery on the jaws, biopsies, placement of dental implants. The way it usually works in this country is the surgeon will place the implant. It takes a few months to integrate to the bone. It takes a few months for that bone to bond to the implant surface and lock it in strong. I'll follow the patient during that time, and once we decide it's strong enough, we'll send them back to their general dentist to make the crown. So we work with the patient's general dentist as a team to accomplish this.
Okay, great. Well, on that note, we'll take a break, and then when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit more about how you get the implants to stick and what you do if there's not enough bone. So let's take a break. Thank you for being here. And we're back. This is East West Medicine. This is Dr. Lily Love.
And Sudha Kailas, and we're here with special guest Dr. Jeff Wheaton, oral surgeon here in Santa Fe. Thanks for being here, Dr. Wheaton.
Thank you for having me.
So before the break, we were talking about a little bit about fillings, filling removal, and also dental implants for people who have lost a tooth. It's sort of an alternative to dentures because it's permanent and, cosmetically and everything, it's a little bit easier for patients. But can you tell us how you, when you put the peg in or the implant, how you get it to stay and what you do if you don't have enough bone to work with?
Sure. That's why we like to have a consultation first. We're able to show the patient images and models and really describe the procedure in detail. I find it's interesting. A lot of patients have a lot of anxiety associated. Well, you're going to put a screw in my jaw. That really sounds painful and difficult. It's actually less painful than extracting a tooth. Extracting a tooth that's been in the body for many, many years is very invasive and traumatic, and it leaves a big defect that takes time to fill in. Placing a dental implant is more precise, more controlled. We use a series of drills, so we start small and then slowly enlarge the hole to the right size of the implant. Slow speed, lots of water irrigation so we don't overheat or traumatize the bone. So again, it's a very controlled procedure. And although we make a hole, we plug it with the implant. So you don't have these sort of raw, exposed nerves. So most patients are pleasantly surprised and relieved. Most take a couple of Advil afterwards, and that's about it.
Wow.
So that's amazing.
The important thing with placing implants is the position, the angulation relative to the adjacent teeth, the opposing teeth and the other arch. And in the front of the mouth, certainly cosmetics is a big issue. So it does take a lot of preoperative planning. I have a 3D, what we call cone beam CT scanner in my office. It used to be years ago, we only had two-dimensional x-rays. But with the advent of the 3D CT scanning, we can really measure the bone very accurately and diagnose the right size implant to put into that area. It used to be in the past, we would occasionally be surprised. We would make an incision, open it up, and there wouldn't be enough bone. What I've found with the new diagnostic capability is that our treatment planning is much more accurate. We don't have those kinds of surprises. And I'm actually doing a lot less bone grafting than I used to. There's more different sizes of implants available now. So I'm finding that we're able to get patients to having a new tooth quicker and less invasively if we can avoid some of the bone grafting procedures we used to do.
Well, you mentioned the CT scanner, and you know, patients have a lot of concern about getting radiation and everything. What's the difference between your scanner and the scanner at the big hospital?
The terminology is confusing, and patients do have read a lot in the lay press the last couple of years about radiation and do have concerns. The type we use in the office is what's called a cone beam CT scanner. It's actually formulated to look at the teeth and the jaws, and it's about 10 to 20 times less the radiation than that big donut type thing in the hospital. So it's, although we call it a CT scan because it gives us three-dimensional images, it's completely different technology and much, much less radiation. The other thing people to think about in terms of dental x-rays just in general, most dental offices now are going to digital x-rays, and digital x-rays have a lot less radiation. When you used to have to radiate a plate and chemically process it, that required more radiation. The sensors now, the digital sensors, are much more sensitive, and you can get that information with much, much lower doses of radiation.
That makes a lot of sense, because obviously you're looking at bone and teeth, and we're not really evaluating soft tissue as much, so you don't need all of that extra radiation.
Correct. But, you know, I do have patients that will occasionally have concerns, and I understand that, but I tell them for me to properly treatment plan their case, you know, I'm not willing to go in and just blindly do it. We do need that information.
Would you do all the dental implants at once, or do you do maybe two at a time, or how does that work?
It really depends. That's what's so interesting about it and why I've enjoyed focusing my practice more on dental implants in the last few years, because we can do anything from replacing a single missing tooth to a patient that's fully dentulous or has no teeth and wears dentures. In those cases, sometimes we can just place 2 to 4 implants in strategic locations, and then they still have a denture, but it's supported and retained by the implants. So speaking is a lot easier. Taste, it's just a lot more secure in wearing that denture. They're not afraid it's going to come out. We call that an implant-supported overdenture. It's still removable. At the end of the day, they can take the denture out. They can clean around those posts. That's important in terms of keeping the gum tissue and the bone healthy. And then we can also do what's called fixed implant-supported bridges. Maybe someone's missing 3 or 4 teeth in a certain part of their mouth. We can place 2 to 3 implants and replace 4 or 5 teeth on those few implants in a situation where they don't have to take it in and out. So there's a lot of different solutions, and it really depends on the patient's problems and needs.
And that's during the treatment process. So when they get to the point where their teeth have been replaced by these implants, those don't come out at the end of the day, correct?
Right. The implants don't come out.
Okay. So,
the implants are embedded in the bone, and then you build a tooth or a bridge on top of it. And in cases of patients that wear dentures, they can have a denture that is still removable. But say in the upper jaw, you don't have to have as much plastic. You're not relying on suction. So that denture can be much more lean, so we don't have to cover the whole palate. And again, it just makes the whole chewing experience and speaking and everything a lot more – it basically stabilizes a patient with existing dentures.
So I understand that it is a case-by-case basis.
Right.
Everybody's jaw, everybody's bone structure is going to be a bit different. But I'm wondering, for those that do wear dentures, is it possible that they can have a full mouth of implants and teeth?
It is. There's actually an exciting new procedure called the all-on-4 procedure. Your listeners could Google that and look it up if they want. I've just started doing this in the last year, and it's really been dramatic and amazing. But patients that are either missing all their teeth or in some cases still have a full set of teeth but are in very bad shape, we can actually bring them in that same day and remove all of the teeth, place 4 implants, and then the patient leaves with what we call a hybrid prosthesis. And we call it a hybrid because it's somewhere between a denture and a fixed bridge. It's built like a denture, but it's screwed onto the implants. And they leave that day with a whole new smile. It's dramatic.
Wow.
And they don't have to take it in or out. And it's also dramatically expensive. But
I can imagine. We
work with a lab in Phoenix. The lab technicians fly here the day of surgery. I do the surgical part, and then the technician stabilizes the denture and checks the bite and all of that. So it's a pretty high-tech procedure.
That's wonderful. I mean, it seems like things have come a long way, and I know that that's something that's really concerning to patients who don't have teeth. You know, a lot of, you know, my patients that we take back for surgery, they don't even want their family members to see them without their teeth. So it's so important that they do get something permanent that, you know, they're not always worried that will fall out or that they'll have to take out at night and not talk to anyone for the rest of the evening. So that seems like a great tool.
Yeah, there's so many variables, and that's why I really have to try to understand the patient and their needs and abilities. I mean, not everyone can afford the all-on-four. You know, some people are highly professionals who are still younger and still working in the public. They say, I've got to come in and get this done in one day, and I have to be back at work next week. That's versus maybe someone who's retired and has a fixed income, but, you know, maybe has a little more time to recover at home and doesn't have to go right out with teeth that day. So I really try to tailor it to what's going to solve the patient's problem in the quickest, least invasive, least expensive way possible.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit, still on the topic of dental implants, but when somebody has thinning bone in their maxilla or the upper jaw, there's this concept of bone grafts. Can you explain what a bone graft is, why someone might need it, and do you put bone in there? How does that work?
Sure. First, let me just kind of lay the foundation. I explained to my patients that bone is there to support the teeth. And when someone loses teeth, that bone slowly starts to melt away over time. So I have patients now that will come in, and maybe they've been missing a tooth or teeth for 20 years, and they'll want a dental implant, and we'll get a CT scan, and the bone may be too thin. And then that's when we have to consider different kinds of grafting procedures to build up the bone. But that's also why I tell patients now, if you're going to lose a tooth, you really want to try to get an implant in as soon as possible, because the implant functions like the tooth root. Those stresses when you're chewing are transmitted to the bone, which keeps the bone healthy and strong. So our whole paradigm has really shifted in terms of treating teeth that way. But to get back to your question about bone grafts, we do have areas such as the front part of the upper jaw where the bone is very thin to begin with, that when someone loses a tooth, by the time it heals, it can often be too thin for a dental implant. The back part of the upper jaw, it's not so much an issue of the bone being thin, but we have a vertical deficit. Basically, the sinuses, the maxillary sinuses, dip way down close to the roots of the teeth in that area. So oftentimes after a patient has lost a tooth, by the time they heal, we measure them, and they may not have enough height of bone to place a dental implant. So there are a number of types of grafting procedures we can do after the fact to build up the bone. That does get more invasive. It does get more expensive. I'd like to focus first, actually, on what we call socket preservation. And that concept is, nowadays, if you're going to go in and have a tooth removed, what I can do is actually open up a bottle of synthetic bone, pack it in the hole right at the time of the extraction. That takes about 3 extra minutes. There is some small additional cost, but what that does, it actually preserves the bone and enhances and optimizes the healing. Because what we found now, if we can preserve that bone at the time of the extraction, that patient's going to be a much better candidate for an implant in a couple of months, as opposed to trying to reconstruct the defect later. That's less predictable and more expensive.
What is synthetic bone?
The product I'm using basically is what we call it's a beta-tricalcium phosphate. It's a calcium phosphate salt. It's granular. It looks like little grains of sand. And again, we take it out of a bottle and pack it in the hole. And the way it acts is by what we call osteoconduction. It forms a scaffold which allows the body's cells to enter the space and then start making bone. So it basically acts to hold the space open. If you take out a tooth, people have been losing teeth for thousands of years, and they'll heal. But what can happen is that socket can collapse, sometimes upwards of 50%. By packing bone into the extraction socket at the time of the extraction, we can prevent about 90% of that bone loss. The nice thing about the synthetic product is, kind of like salt and water, it eventually dissolves. So as the body's making new bone, it melts away. And I have a lot of patients that are kind of relieved to hear that. Within a year and a half, it's completely gone, and it's just your body's own bone.
It seems that the osteoblasts, perhaps, that are involved in creating the new bone may use some of these materials, though, in creating the new bone. Is that correct?
They do. It's fascinating. I actually find when I go back in that the bone is sometimes more dense than the surrounding native bone would be. And I can also see that radiographically on the cone beam CT. It'll show up as what we call radiopaque, very dense, especially in the upper jaw where the bone is naturally softer and spongier. So what I find is with the bone graft, yet that liberated free calcium is often incorporated into the new bony matrix, and it really provides a good foundation. Basically, you think of a dental implant as a screw. It's a fancy screw made of titanium. And when you want to put a screw in, you want to put it in nice solid wood, not into mushy drywall.
Yes, definitely.
And in the past, they used to use bovine or cow bone or cadaver bone from people. Is that right?
Correct.
Is that still done?
There are some practitioners that still do that. I've been strictly using the newer synthetics for the last 5 or 6 years, both philosophically and also because of just empirically in my clinical experience since I've started using it, I find that it's more predictable than the cadaver or bovine bone. I also have some concerns, and I'm sure some patients do, about even though the donor bone is processed, in my mind there is more of a potential for some proteins and antigenicity and things of that nature. So I find that a lot of patients are pretty relieved to hear when you're not going to put in dead human bone or dead cow bone.
Makes sense. Yeah. As a consumer, I can totally understand that.
Yes, it seems that the synthetic bone is much more like a vitamin that you're actually using to fill the...
Pretty much, it's just an inorganic... it's the same inorganic compounds that make up our bones and teeth.
Well, it sounds as though things have really come a long way. Just a few days ago was George Washington's birthday, and everyone talks about his wooden teeth. So, you know, I think people from those days would be amazed how far things can have come as far as, you know, replacing teeth, you know, in an essentially permanent basis.
That poor man suffered so bad. I went to Mount Vernon a few years ago, and all they talked about was how bad his teeth were.
Really? That's interesting.
But, yeah, there have been – I think the advances in dentistry and dental surgery have been mostly along the lines of materials, also the 3D imaging that we have, and these sort of CAD-CAM robotic milling of parts and pieces. So it's really been an exciting evolution the last 5-6 years. It's really gotten me all fired up about dentistry again. It's really neat.
It's interesting how things just continue to evolve, even, you know, things 20 years ago that didn't exist, and now there's a lot of options for patients. And as we know, that's one of the first things that you see when you meet someone is their smile, and it's so important for people to be able to confidently smile and not feel some sort of embarrassment that they don't have teeth or they have, you know, bad teeth.
Absolutely, and if I can give some information, I'd be glad to tell you how to contact me.
Great. So please let our listeners know. We have about a minute left, but please tell them how they can get in touch and what services you offer in your website.
Okay. So my office number here in Santa Fe, it's 505-992-1550. And unless someone calls and say they have an acute abscess and they're in pain and it has to come out that day, we really prefer to have a consultation first. That way we can try to analyze your problem, find the solution that's best going to fit, and then really give patients a good cost estimate so there's no surprises and they know what to expect. So 992-1550. They can also go to www.santafeoralsurgeons.com.
Thank you, Dr. Wheaton. We really appreciate you being here, and it sounds as though there's a lot more topics to discuss, so we hope to have you back one of these days.
I'd like to come back. Appreciate it. Thank
you. Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in today to East West Medicine. We're your hosts, Drs. Lily Love and Sudha Kailas. If you have any comments or suggestions for show topics or guests, please email us at eastwestmedshow@gmail.com. We'd also like to thank Desert Dwellers at desertdwellers.org for sponsoring our soothing music.